Welcome to the Banking Reinvented podcast. Every week, we discuss how banks can progressively modernize their customer journeys and model business operations around their customers. You're listening to Tim Rutten, and I'll be joined by Backbase CEO and founder Jouk Pleiter and other senior banking leaders from around the globe. Ready to unpack how to re-architect banking together? Let's get started. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to a fresh episode of Banking Reinvented, where today I'm going to be joined by Marco Santarelli. Marco is our VP of Channels here at Backbase. You've been around the block quite a few years already, Marco. Perhaps you can do a quick introduction before we get started.
Of course. Thanks, Tim, for the introduction. Indeed, it's been my 10 years anniversary not too long ago here at Backbase. Done a bit of everything, mostly focused, as my role implies, on web and mobile lately, but I started as part of the CS organization for quite a long time. So getting to work with our product, our customers, supporting them in implementations for about 6 years. And then only recently enough, 4 years ago, joining the product organization, where my first mission was indeed to try and leverage my knowledge of how the product was adopted and implemented to exercise a few changes in architecture to improve the technology stack and the ease of adoption of our platform.
Cool. So basically, you're responsible for all the channels of the Backbase platform at this moment in time. So that's both the web channel as well as the mobile channel. And any engineering that happens in that domain, that's basically under your responsibility.
Correct. Yes.
Fantastic. All right. Then with that introduction, we would also typically ask the participant of the podcast to share news that was a highlight for them, either literally today or over the past few weeks, that in your domain has been of particular interest or that resonated with you. Anything that comes to mind, Marco?
I think it's very difficult not to mention the CrowdStrike outage that happened recently. I think maybe it's not necessarily only in the front-end domain, but really touched the entire IT industry as a whole. It goes to show how very minor, potentially a minor vendor problem could create such a cascade of issues across the entire industries. We've seen issues in airports, even where flights were being canceled because of this outage that, for the people that are not familiar, meant an incompatibility between a endpoint protection system and the Microsoft Windows operating system, meant these devices, these computers would crash unexpectedly and become unusable and impossible to recover straight away. CrowdStrike was owning quite a fair share of the market in this space. So very pervasive impact of this problem. I don't want to be in the shoes of that engineer that created this outage, to be honest.
I can only imagine. If you would similarly have an outage in the context of Backbase, it would also have an impact, certainly, with 100 plus customers live on this technology that we deliver. But nevertheless, for CrowdStrike, I think all the newspapers were out there. It was a blue screen day. Airports are the most lively example of where it really hits home almost. I think by now, the majority of the work has been done, but there's still a backlog of potentially years of manual work to update all these different systems, right?
Indeed, and it goes to show also how dependent we are on this technology, where there's no fallback, right? There's no other alternative. And I think it's also a good segue to the topic that we wanted to talk about today, right?
Yeah. We are going to talk about polyglot architecture. And perhaps you can first set the stage a little bit why this topic is so important to you and maybe in the breath what it means to the industry.
Yeah, it's not a new concept, right? Polyglot architectures have been around for quite some time. As the name implies, it's basically the ability to use multiple programming languages, multiple frameworks and different technologies together in a single system. It's something that was originally introduced with the micro front-end architecture for web and the microservices architecture on the API layers. The reason to introduce such a system is to address the complexity of these big IT infrastructure ecosystems and parcelize them, make them more manageable. Do you risk larger dependencies and the complexity of these systems by creating smaller units, independent as much as possible? The goal to leverage a poly language architecture or multiple frameworks here is because of reasons that might become apparent from legacy software that is already deployed in the bank, or because there are better tools for the job depending on the use case. There's many benefits in being able to do so with a minimal overhead.
So if I zoom out for a moment, you basically have architectural choices to make in any context, in any system. And if I'm hearing you correctly, Marco, then you're saying that a polyglot architecture is like a bit of a slicing and dicing opportunity to bring the right framework, the right language to the right job almost. Is that a fair, super high level, but is that fair?
That is definitely one of the reasons why you would want to put a polyglot architecture in place. Yeah, there's more.
Yeah, the second thing I'm hearing is making smaller units, which originally started with the containerization, of course, of different architectural components. But these smaller units are then also supposedly more manageable or more easily digestible in your organization so that you don't have this massive behemoth of technology you need to maintain, but you actually have smaller pockets of capabilities that are a bit more, guarded off almost.
Yeah, the two concepts are synergic, really, right? So when you containerize, when you adopt, when you move away from a traditional monolithic architecture, you definitely, your goal is to create clear boundaries across your capabilities so that you don't influence each other as much as possible, so that you can progress, innovate independently. And the ability to do so in different frameworks and different languages is a plus. Let's say it complements this goal quite well, because then you can choose the better tool for the job depending on your use case, or perhaps depending on your legacy infrastructure, so that you have to you don't have to do a big bang migration. You can incrementally get there and modernize incrementally and progressively.
So if you compare this to a typical traditional technology stack or more traditional architecture, the difference is that architecture is almost rigid, monolithic. It's one major system that encompasses everything and has a lot of technology choices that might be clearly suboptimal, if I may say it like that. Whereas the more newer view would be in a polyglot architecture, it's in smaller units, it's in smaller elements of capabilities, and you literally make different trade-offs on a lower level to optimize the overall architecture. Now, if we then bring this to a benefits view, because in a way, this still sounds like a lot of work and a lot of different technologies, which means, are you creating even newer legacy because you're introducing so many different new frameworks? Or how do you see that?
That is the danger indeed. So it's a bit of a double-edged sword in this case, especially in the banking industry, which is the one I'm most familiar with. You definitely see already a lot of technologies being used. Then you might argue these banks already live in a polyglot architecture in a way. I think the important aspect to keep in mind is that in order for you to have a successful polyglot architecture, then you need to make sure that you don't have issues of maintenance consistency of your code base, of your systems. They need to still work as a cohesive single system. And the traditional banking setup very often doesn't have that characteristic, right? You typically see silos, you typically see little reuse of capabilities because of the technology incompatibilities. And that is not a polyglot architecture, right? I think the important first aspect to keep in mind is it needs to be a deliberate choice and not the result of perhaps technical debt accumulation over the years. Like you say, the risk is indeed that there's little governance, little control, and you end up with a platform and then it becomes impossible to manage, difficult to operate. So you need to have a guiding framework that allows you to achieve this polyglot architecture by supporting basically the connection and the differences between the technologies you use. So having a platform in place that allows you to do, or at least make some of this complexity transparent to the engineers, transparent to the consumers of your system, it's of paramount importance.
So two parts. One, it's a deliberate choice. So it really starts with the choice for a polyglot architecture to actually be able to reap the benefits. Because without the deliberate choice, you're just introducing newer technologies. And you almost gave the freedom of flexibility to your engineering departments and or vendors to deliver in whatever framework or technology they believe is the best for the job. But you're never going to be able to bring it together in a cohesive way that it really delivers value as much as you would have been able to with a deliberate choice. And then the second part, you mentioned governance, or at least I like to mention governance here. Do you have a strong guiding framework in place to manage all of this? Because to me, it seems like the risky part here is similar to the Spotify model, or at least in the early days where everyone would autonomously be able to deliver whatever value they would like to deliver on a technology platform with any framework or any technology they would desire. That is, that's architectural suicide almost, if I at least can tap into my personal experience. But what does that look like, Mark, with a type of guiding framework?
I think there are two aspects of it, right? So like you say, the deliberate aspect is important because that means that there was an analysis done based on the requirement, on the use case in particular, that justifies or motivates the choice of technology dissonance between your various systems. We can get maybe into the details later of what are scenarios where we see that happening today. But for instance, even just the availability of talent for a specific technology in your area could be a good reason, right? So it's not necessarily just a concern of the technology itself. It could be also factors external to your IT infrastructure. But the other aspect of it is that you need to have not necessarily governance, but a secret sauce, a technique, practices that sort of take away the risk of then creating something that is non-manageable. In the example that we were bringing before, so the microservices architecture, the secret sauce in that case was the containerization, right? So you were able to deploy and manage whatever technology you might dream of if you were able to containerize it and deliver REST APIs, for instance, to interact with other parts of the system. Then all of a sudden, it was not really important which technology you used inside of your container, as long as you could have this boundary, this black box that you could deploy somewhere without being wiser on how it was implemented internally, right? So this was probably the first pioneering technology that allowed these polyglot architectures to really succeed, because it's then only the responsibility of a team that delivers just that individual granular capability to figure out the concerns. We have been seeing in the recent years the same tendency, the same industry support for similar patterns also in the web world and in the mobile world through micro frontends and the evolution of the mobile SDKs. So we've been supported, right? We are not reinventing the wheel here, but the industry is leading the charge and allowing us and giving us a tool to take away that complexity for us.
Could you maybe dive a bit deeper on the actual implications to the channels? I think on the back end, that is, at least if I follow you correctly, that's still rather stable, right? Those are still the microservice patterns, the containerization, the majority now becoming way more cloud native. So even that containerization aspect is, you just consume it from the cloud, I would imagine. But how does this relate to the actual channels at this moment in time? And before you go there, when I myself was still in the field doing the field work and indeed working with the architects of the bank to help them understand what the trade-offs were for the front-end architectures, we would often find ourselves in a debate between frameworks. And at that moment in time, it was React.js, it was Angular. There was a whole Angular upgrade that was problematic for the industry because it was almost a hard cutoff. Where are we today in the industry when it relates to those frameworks? And then how does that dovetail into the concepts that you just shared, where you can have micro frontends or at least have different technologies running and supporting the channels?
Yeah, that's basically it, right? So the industry evolved around the concept of this sort of almost bipartisan division in the industry where everyone follows religiously one framework or the other. It was more of an issue in the web context because obviously technology matured much faster and it was less stable than what you noticed in other disciplines. And so over there, we had these kind of issues where you had to make a choice and stick with it. But this also matured eventually in the industry to evolve these frameworks themselves. So to survive, a framework needed to be able to be compatible. And there was a drive to try and find patterns, find techniques to combine these frameworks. A very good example, in my opinion, in that space is what Webpack did. Webpack is a tool to package and bundle your code and deliver it in an efficient way to browsers. They introduced a feature called Module Federation, which basically, in simple terms, enabled you to remotely download your dependencies for your overall application. And this was done in such a way that it was completely agnostic of whatever language, whatever framework you were using, as long as it was compatible with Webpack, which is a very generic tool that has to deal with the technologies we use in browsers, so JavaScript. And typically, you always have this kind of boundary created for you. And in the world of web means you have the JavaScript language, you have the DOM, and then every framework that has to leverage those tools can abstract to that level. And Module Federation did that for the front end. You started seeing examples of micro front end architectures that were seamlessly integrated, host applications maybe built in Angular that could easily inject remotes coming from React.js applications or Vue.js applications. So you name it, right? And little by little, you saw the industry sort of facing the same issues because of the fragmentation. And naturally, that was a need that emerged. And as the open source community often does, it was addressed and solved in a brilliant way. I think that's a very good example of how eventually the emerging pattern presented itself in the frameworks that were the mainstream ones. Maybe to mention one important aspect of this is obviously it's not for free, right? There is complexity in managing a polyglot architecture. Maybe we didn't really make that clear so far, but it means it needs to be a deliberate choice, like we were saying earlier. And there needs to be perhaps an evaluation of what is the roadmap for your architecture. How are you going to evolve it in time? Because it is a living thing. It's not something that is stable. You constantly try to modernize, to innovate. So that aspect is also important. And Polyglot is really powerful in that because it allows you to avoid having to do that evolution, to do that change all at once. But you can incrementally achieve that.
Yeah, thanks for giving some color there. And indeed, if you look at the industry moves that you describe, you basically see a religion of frameworks where at that moment in time, it was, we just want to go for React or we just want to go for Angular or the next best alternative that next week is popular. And that challenge was really there. And I think also the architectural pattern where they became more compatible, those were not in sight. So you had to make that choice, which was challenging at that moment in time. Because, yeah, there was always a different trade-off. There was always a different framework that just felt better for that particular group in an institution like a bank, as an example.
What I personally felt is that a framework needs to enable you, right? At the end of the day, there's no silver bullet. There's always going to be a certain aspect or a certain implementation need that is better achieved with one tool or another. But committing to a particular framework and really embracing its features is what really accelerates you in building things. In my opinion, the smart choice to do at the time was not discuss too long about which one is best. Just pick the one that is good enough for the job because not 100% of your requirement will ever be. As time has shown, that was indeed the smart choice because basically all the mainstream frameworks that you would have adopted back in the day now come with a path forward to embed other frameworks or other technologies. In my experience, it was also a bit of a technology rejection in what I was building at the time, right? Customers adopting the product that I was building always had that objection. But I think React is better, but I think Vue.js is better. Losing a bit the sight of the value that we were delivering, right? We're not really giving a customer software. We're giving an implementation of a business value, an implementation of a feature that their customers are going to use. I think that was easy to lose sight of when this sort of religious arguments across frameworks were going on.
Yeah, no, it happened every other week and at large scale transformational efforts. Now, if you elevate this discussion, it starts and ends with what is the business value that's going to be delivered. And then you would look at what type of technology would support this goal with longevity. So you need to be able to do this step by step, do it progressively, and make sure there's smaller units of capabilities so that you have the right technology choices. But it starts with that business value conversation. And indeed, if you have very talented engineering folks in the room, but they lack that strategic narrative or they lack that business acumen, then they will do what engineering leaders might do or could do, become very passionate technology, as passionate about the actual value it will be delivering over time. Now, interestingly enough, if I take your work view where you say, hey, frameworks were very religiously decided for. By now, the pattern in the industry has changed because they are more compatible and you can actually run multiple in the same channel or in the same application if you'd like. Meaning, it's almost like a no-brainer anymore. It's not a blocker. You can have it all, but that also comes with a responsibility. It is not for free, right?
It is not. So obviously, there is complexity. Namely, even at the very most basic level, you have a workforce that needs to be trained in multiple technologies, right? That's the first step there. And the more technology you add to the mix, the more training, the more skills, the harder it is to find experts in each one that needs to have, let's say, a cross team or cross technology or a system-wide knowledge of your infrastructure. And the more technologies you add, the more complex that becomes. Inevitably, you can make it as transparent and as easy as you can, but eventually there is a cost in maintaining this complexity. Anyways, it's important to strike the right balance and make that choice when it's needed, when it's motivated, when there is a value add. Otherwise, it's not a wise choice, right? Obviously, the best possible architecture is an infinitely consistent one built on top of the same technology, but that's not always an easy task. That's not always possible. Other problems that might arise, like we were hinting at before, are the fragmentation. So you might find yourself having to re-implement some common patterns, some common software, because you need such a feature in multiple aspects, in multiple technologies across your system. And where it's not easy to factor it out, then you have basically double the work or triple the work, depending on how many languages or many technologies you adopt. And that drives up the costs for the organization, right? It drives up the maintenance, it drives up the infrastructural need, perhaps the complexity and the overhead of developing new feature potentially is affected. So you need to do it smartly. You need to find techniques that allow you to limit that impact whenever you choose a new technology to add to the mix.
Yeah. Before we go to the next part, there was this one note that you mentioned on talent. And it is a very interesting one because talent is scarce, especially those that have multiple frameworks under their belt. I think it sounds like a unicorn profile. So do you already in the industry see a bit of talent arbitrage where the choice is, let's say, skewed towards, we'll go for this technology. It might not be optimal for the use case, but at least we can find the people to execute on the ambition. Do you see that already happening?
It is happening 100%. And it's also interesting to see how, depending on the country we're talking about, that might differ, right? So you might see that a specific framework or technology is really more popular in a country because perhaps the inventor of that technology were from the same country, or because it was, let's say, more strongly advertised as a popular choice in that space. Being a global organization, I think we experienced a lot of that in the years, and I always found it fascinating. But indeed, let's say at the end of the day, you have to make a choice. It's very difficult to be a polyglot expert, right? We are talking about difficult, complex technologies. So typically engineers are specializing more and more because the baggage of knowledge they need to have is growing larger and larger. So we saw it in the years for the discipline itself, right? When I started my career, we weren't talking about a front-end engineer, a back-end engineer. We were talking about a software engineer. And then eventually that specialization started happening more and more. And I think nowadays you start seeing engineers advertising themselves as an Angular engineer or a Spring engineer, right? So the frameworks, the technologies have become so pervasive and so large that the knowledge across the board is almost impossible to have.
Yeah, it's like the frameworks are almost dominant over what gets implemented into the market because they have a certain population that can actually support the technology. And then you have an ecosystem. And yeah, before you were out of that picture, you're a few years further down the line. But I think overall, it is quite clear, Marco. It's a deliberate choice. You need strong governance and guidance. And you have a talent opportunity. Where also I believe Polyglot can attract talent because they have a bit more leeway, a bit more flexibility to experiment with newer languages and not just be almost like a factory worker just doing one thing and one thing only. I think creativity also plays into the mix there.
Absolutely. It's a powerful tool to innovate as well.
Now, moving on to the next part, bring it back to our context, Marco. If I listen to the patterns that are now available in the market, apparently any institution, any bank could implement a polyglot architecture and be successful, at least at a very high level. However, I do not personally see this pattern just yet in the market. So my main question would be also for the audience, what is holding banks back? What needs to be in place to be able to leverage this appropriately?
I think banks are not necessarily always software companies, right? Most of the time, at least for the larger one, they are forced to be, but in general, it's something that they would gladly avoid becoming experts of. I think if they could leverage tooling that allows them to remove this technical debt, to achieve an efficient polyglot architecture that allows them to progressively modernize their stack and remove the technical debt that they accumulated over the years, So in my opinion, what's needed in this space is a platform that enables these banks to do so, to follow that guidelines, follow that patterns that eventually will get them to an architecture that is more self-consistent, where reuse is promoted, where interoperability becomes easy, and that enables banks to, a platform that enables banks to achieve so incrementally, not by starting a 3-4 years program that eventually will bring them there. But by the time it's completed, you already end up with an outdated system again that you probably need to, again, unpack and rebuild from scratch. I think that's a big enabler for banks to achieve this.
So it very much connects to the composable architecture that we've also spoken about multiple times in the previous episodes. Where composability to me fully indicates the flexibility of an architecture to indeed drive polyglot architectural decisions, but also to progressively modernize your institution bit by bit, week over week, month over month, and not go for 3 to 4 years larger big bang transformation. I guess this very well plays into that metaphor or into that strategy for the architecture. And if I'm listening to you correctly, then building that type of platform to have that type of capability, what would be your guess or estimate, Marco? Is that something that you can do within a year, 2 years, 3 years, if you start from scratch today with your knowledge?
I've been doing it for 10 years and I'm still not done. I think it's a massive effort that, because of the nature of the business, because of the complexities involved, it's a job that is never done, right? This platform can always be improved, can always be embraced. And that's why, in my view, it's not a one-off exercise. It's something that should be embraced as a way of working, jumping on this train that moves along and helps institutions modernize themselves constantly. And again, maybe bringing the discussion towards buy versus build, and always a difficult and nuanced one, especially for larger organizations. I think you can buy a lot of expertise in that sense by adopting and buying a platform that covers all those horizontal requirements for you and complement that expertise with the ability to build. So if we extrapolate a bit the discussion we were just having in the composable model bank space or in the composable platform architecture, we are doing what the backend industry has done with microservices, right? We are enabling institutions somehow to pick and choose what they need out of the platform. And that inherently comes with the need to build what it's not picked. How do you build it? We don't want to have a strong opinion on the technology you use necessarily, right? So with the polyglot architecture, it means that we lower the technology rejection. You ease finding expertise for the institutions. Maybe they have already an opinionated way of working. So it's trying to bring the best of both worlds in there. And it's not buy or build, but it's buy and build that is enabled for these institutions.
Yeah. I'm sure that resonates with the audience that is buying or that is implementing. Now, moving to the final part of the episode for today, Marco, we spoke about what was the situation 5 to 10 years ago when it was more of a framework by religion and you had to make a hard cut decision. We discussed where we are today, where the frameworks can actually coexist and you get a polyglot architecture across the full set of different layers of an architecture. In your view, in the coming 5 to 10 years, where will we end up? What are your, let's say, future perspectives on the architecture overall?
I think if the industry continues on this path, we can expect more and more efforts in bringing this interoperability to the various frameworks, especially the frameworks that want to stay relevant, want to stay alive. The technologies that today we use have to incorporate some form of interoperability. It wouldn't be an IT discussion if we didn't bring AI into the mix. I think that's also a big drive for this polyglot architecture, because the de facto standard for AI implementation and models is Python. It's a language that perhaps not every financial institution especially is necessarily familiar with, but it's the tool of choice to use AI at an advanced state. And so by nature, it means that at least for that particular nail, you need to use the right hammer, and so to speak. So you need to pick the right tool for the job, and it would be impressively difficult to use something different. So that's, to me, for instance, the perfect example that in the next 5 to 10 years will motivate a shift of financial institutions, fintechs, to embrace a polyglot architecture out of necessity because of AI, for instance. I think we need to work on enabling the shift as an industry. So I think what we'll also see in the next years is a focus on the developer experience and productivity. So seeing more tools and more frameworks that enable a polyglot architecture, but also a lot of more evolved learning opportunities for engineers. I think we'll see more and more material that enables upskilling of our engineers to become familiar with these topics and to become experts at achieving a polyglot architecture effectively. And last but not least, I think what's really fundamental for all of this to work is a strong API ecosystem, right? As long as we have a stable, reliable API layer in our architecture, standardized around common entities, common patterns, that allows the integration across the various systems and the various technologies, then we keep the boundaries of each individual granular capability manageable, because we have that stability, that strong base that allows them to communicate.
There's a lot of architectural leadership needed as well, I would imagine, right? The actual leadership that day in, day out works with all the different pockets of engineers that are delivering these types of capabilities. I think that oversight and that almost craftsmanship and leadership behavior has to be there as well. Because otherwise it's like theoretically makes a lot of sense, but the day-to-day means being there and driving it and also holding off of decisions that are contra the architecture that you're trying to implement.
Indeed, and perhaps maybe in that space, you find a renewed attention towards including, let's say, the channels into your architecture. Typically, the complex parts of the architecture a few years ago were your integrations, your services, your deployments, your infrastructure. And that was the first big hurdle to overcome with the microservices architecture. But nowadays, you see a renewed focus on the architecture of your web application, of your mobile applications, because that's where a lot of development effort is also invested in. And it's typically a good slice of the effort needed to bring digital transformation to life for a financial institution. And so you see a lot of renewed focus and engineers growing into this architect role, not only from the backend side of the fence, but also from these complex application deployments, because it has become very complex in that area, in that space as well.
Indeed. Marco, thanks for the insights so far. Let me try to take a stab on the key takeaways or the summary. I would say that overall, it's all about business value, right? Regardless of your architecture, regardless of the decisions, you have to make business value-driven decisions to begin with. And what we've walked through over the past episode is that you effectively are looking to move away from a monolithic architecture to a very much composable and progressive architecture that allows you to progressively modernize your full stack. And in doing so, actually giving you the capability of leveraging a polyglot approach, meaning you can choose frameworks, you can choose technologies that are fit for the job. Now, this choice doesn't come easy. It doesn't come for free per se, Marco. You're very clear about that. Although it does allow you to de-risk, although it does allow you to build smaller units of capabilities and make it way more manageable, it does come with the trade-off that you will introduce more technologies into your ecosystem. So your engineers will similarly need to be able to support those technologies. So adding every new technology or framework has a serious cost to be considered, which could still deliver value, right? So don't get me wrong, the ROI might still be there and might still be the best tool for the job, but that consideration has to be there from the CTO, CIO, all the way down to the architects in the day-to-day execution. You also mentioned what success looks like. And what success looks like in a polyglot architecture is that it is fully interoperable. And that is a key design pattern almost. That it is consistent, that it drives reusability of the same capability or the same value that you're looking to also leverage in other channels or in other parts of the system without duplicating that in other frameworks. So you really do want to drive for that synergy, because otherwise you've literally not reached the goal of a polyglot architecture. And then, yeah, the final few takeaways I would like to share is that one, it has to be a deliberate choice. Don't end up in a polyglot architecture just by, yeah, let's say, accident indeed, because that's going to be a very costly affair. bring very strong governance and very strong guidance to how to maneuver within that architecture that is being designed by the architectural oversight group. Because if that isn't there, then potentially the engineers might make different decisions and you end up with a very subpar product load architecture, which might even drag you down. It might even not get the benefits, if not the worst parts of having all those technologies at play. And then the final part is more talking about optimizing it for the talent in the market that you operate in, because you still need hands to keyboard to deliver. And if you overcomplicate the technology choices and the framework choices, although in theory they might be sound, if you cannot find the people to do the work and to run the shop, then yeah, it's a beautiful dream, but it's never going to happen. So yeah, those are my main takeaways for the conversation, Marco. Anything you would like to add or that you would like to highlight further?
No, I think you did a great job of summing up all the main aspects in there. I think maybe the last thing I would add is also the evolving nature of this architecture. So the experimentation, the aspects of introducing innovation in the company, that's a very powerful tool to have in your armamentary in order for you to do that in an incremental pattern. And AI is the perfect example of that.
Marco, thank you so much for sharing your perspective. It was very insightful, a lot of new topics, and we're going to be back in a future episode for sure to dive even deeper. Thanks, Marco.
Sounds good.
Have a good day.
Thanks, Tim. You too. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Banking Reinvented, a podcast by Backbase. Make sure to follow both Jouk and myself on LinkedIn, where we will be sharing key insights about our journey towards modernizing banking.